Okay, here we go. Parshas Tazria, Tafshin Ayin Aleph. Alrighty. We're going to start out with a bunch of questions. Now, the first questions we're going to start with, you might remember from like 4 years ago when we spoke about these issues, but we are, Mirat Hashem, going to reinvestigate them and add to them new depths of meaning based on what we've learned and based on some previous themes. And of course, don't be surprised, but as always, themes in this parsha, as you will see, go directly back to themes of the Eitz Hadas, but different aspects of it. Okay, different aspects. So we're going to start out with a couple of questions. First of all, in the beginning of the parsha, Perek Yud Beis, Pesukim Beis and Gimel, here is the halacha, Dabro B'nei Yisrael. Hashem said to Moshe, speak to Klal Yisrael, v'leimor, tell them. Isha ki tazria, if a woman in a, gives birth, really, she, in a sense, tazria comes from the shoresh zera, seed. She, like, plants a seed, or she gives forth seed. And you know what seed is. In the mushal, a tree drops a seed, and that seed becomes another tree. And when a person gives birth, right, so in a sense, that is how they continue to exist in the next generation. It's like a seed, right, that is from the source and becomes its own tree. V'yolda zachar, and she gives birth to a male. So v'tuma shivas yamim, and she is therefore tamei, impure, which we will discuss, for 7 days. Kimei nidas dosa, just like the 7 days that she's impure when she's a nida. So here, right away, you see that the impurity of childbirth and the impurity of the menstrual cycle are very connected. Both are seven-day cycles of impurity. And b'yom hashmini, and on the eighth day, and we just had yom hashmini, right? So there's obviously associations between the concept of the eighth day in which the Shekhinah came down, and there was a connection between the Shekhinah and human beings, and the great yearning for human beings to be more attached to the Shekhinah, right? Last week's theme. So on this eighth day, Yimol, Basar, Arlaso, you will do a bris milah. You will circumcise the flesh of his Orla. Okay? Now, here the Chazal say, this is a Gemara that my grandfather brings down, a Gemara in Nida. Okay? So listen to this. Why? Mipnei ma amra Torah mila l'shmona? Why does the Torah say, why does the Torah command that you do bris milah on the eighth day? Interesting answer. You know, eighth day, of course, is going to symbolize kedusha and tahara, holiness and sanctity. And we're going to explain what tahara and what tumah is, purity and impurity. But here's the answer. Shelo yihyu kulam smechem. So it shouldn't be a case where everybody's happy, having a party, doing bris milah. It's a mitzvah, right? And his father and mother are sad. Now, why would they be sad? So Rashi explains, that everybody else is happy, eating and drinking, having a suda, having a feast. But his parents are sad because they're forbidden to each other. She's tameh. Okay. So now, a couple of questions on this. Number one. When do we encounter ever the concept that a person is sad when, even though, you know, because they have to do a mitzvah, they can't do a mitzvah because they're sad? There's no dispensation not to do a mitzvah because they're sad. And does it make a person sad that they can't, that the concept of nida or separation makes a person sad? Then what happens every single month? All the mitzvahs that take place in that 2 week period, they should be absolved from because they're sad. Just like here, right? You don't make a bris milah in the first 7 days because the mother's tummy. Therefore, they're separated. Therefore, they're sad. Therefore, they can't do the mitzvah with joy. So, therefore, you wait till the eighth day. Okay? Now, this was obviously before the Nashim Tzidkaniyos increased, you know, the time period, and it was no longer 7 days. It was added. But la halacha, according to the Torah, the 7 days, they're tameh, they're separated, and therefore they're absolved. You don't want to do a mitzvah. That's a very strange concept. First of all, as we said, when do you ever get the concept of being sad that allows you to be free of a mitzvah? And then if that's the case, what about every month? Okay, and the third thing really is, and then what right, therefore, did the women have to kind of create this added stringency, which is what we call the Shiva Nikiyam, the seven extra days, which keeps men, the husbands and wives separated even longer if this is the danger. So that's question number one, which we're going to get to. Okay? Question number two is, and that's the Masechta in the Gemara in Nida. Question number two comes from the Medrash Rabbah, the Medrash. And the Medrash is counterpart, really, part of the oral law, very much part of the oral law, counterpart to the Gemara, which explains the oral law. And here's what the Medrash says on this first pasuk. Isha ki tazria, if a woman gives forth seed and gives birth. The Medrash says, Hadahu dechtiv, this is what David HaMelech means in Tehillim, Kuf Lamid Tes. Okay, in Tehillim, 139 pasuk. Hey, this is a 6-word pasuk, and it's almost incomprehensible. What does David mean? And they explain that pasuk in Tehillim is explained by this pasuk in Tazria. So the pasuk in Tehillim says, Achar v'kedem tzartani, backwards and forwards you formed me, or before and after, or after rather, achor, after, achare, after, and kedem, kodem, previous, you formed me. And then the last half of the pasuk says, v'toshes alai kapecha, and you placed your hand on me. Now, what does that mean? So the Medrash brings here the following. Rav Yochanan says, im zacha adam nochel shnei olamos hazeh. Rav Yochanan says, if a person is worthy, then they inherit, they're worthy of two worlds, this world and the next world. Hazeh v'haba, this one and the next one. Hadehu dichtiv, and that's what it means, achor, acharei, the future, the one after. V'kedem, and the one kodem, before, tzartani, that you form me for the afterworld, the future world, and this previous, earlier world. Okay, that's number one. And if not, if a person is not meritorious, in other words, they don't live well, then they have to ultimately give a din v'cheshbon. They have to give a calculation for how they lived. Shenemar, and that's what the last half of the pasuk means, v'toshes alai kapecha, you put your hand on me. Now, what does that mean? How does that relate to Tazria? If a woman gives birth, the Medrash says, that's what the Tehillim means, that you created me for the future and for the previous. And that's if I'm good, but if I'm bad, you put your hand on me. How does this have anything to do with Parshas Tazria? Well, the hint to this is that Parshas Tazria, which deals with various forms of tumah that emanate from a person's body, nida, menstrual cycle, birth, emissions for a man, and saras, which is some type of lesion that erupts from the body, all of these types of tumah, of impurity, that are kind of bodily expression, some type of lesion on the body or emission from the body or something the body kind of creates or is a vehicle to express. All of these types of tumas are discussed right after the last subject of the last parsha, which are all the tame animals. So then Chazal say, why is human tuma discussed after animal tuma, the tame birds and the tame animals and tame insects? Because there's two options for a person, and you know this famous idea, and this is brought down in the Medrash in Bereishis, that we say when a person is created, we say if a person lives worthily, then we say you are the purpose of creation. Everything in creation was just a build-up for you, and you contain aspects of every element of creation, and you are the pinnacle of creation. But if a person is not worthy, we say even the slightest amoeba basically was created before you. So that's why a tuma of human tuma is discussed after animal tuma, to tell you that the human being is on the higher level if they're worthy after the animal, and if they're not worthy, they come before the animal. It's all not quite clearly defined, okay? So first of all, to try to make sense of this, we just recognize this. How is it that a person who lives worthily is the pinnacle of creation, and everything created prior to the human being is all purposeful and useful because it serves to elevate, and the person can use all previous levels that are created before it to bring everything to its ultimate purpose, to its prior, you know, to its value, and the human being becomes the culmination. Everything culminates in the human being. Think about it like this. The Nitziv brings this down, that that there are four levels of creation. There's what we call the inanimate, like the rocks, which, by the way, they look inanimate to us, but they're made up of atoms that are swirling and moving with tremendous speed. They're not, you know, they're not motionless, but they seem inanimate. They stay where they are. Then there's the tzomeach, the plants and the trees, growing things. Then there is the chai, the walking, the animals, things that are alive with a life force and independently moving on their own. And then there is the medaber, the speaking, thinking creature. And above that is the Klal Yisrael with an neshama that not only is thinking and speaking, but is attached to real emes. Now, interestingly enough, even though it's tzomeach, let's say a growing creature, like a plant, okay, is a level higher than a domain, than an inanimate object, when you cut down that plant, it doesn't continue to live as an inanimate object. It doesn't live at all, right? It doesn't go back to its lower level. It actually dies completely, and when it dies, unlike inanimate objects, it has a terrible smell, a terrible consistency, the texture changes, the whole thing becomes repulsive. We've spoken about that, right? About death and the decay of death. Take the next level. An animal that is killed doesn't start to live as a vegetable. Like, right, just, you know, with a lesser life force, it's completely dead. And more than that, the smell is terrible, the decay is worse, the infection and the disease that comes from it is worse. Every level. And when a human being doesn't exist on its level, it's worse than a dead animal and a dead plant and an inanimate object. In other words, what we're saying here is there's a progression. Each level of creation brings something into the world that can be utilized and elevated by a human being. If those levels are not reached in order, then the person is worse than the first level. That's what it's saying. If a person reaches the high madriga that they're expected to reach, then everything prior to that is just kind of building up towards the perfection or adding to the perfection, which we'll talk about in a second. But if a person doesn't, then an amoeba, then the lowest creature that could be similar to man and that has some degree of life is more important. Now, how does a human being elevate all the previous levels of creation and utilize them and make them purposeful? So Rav Hunter speaks about this in terms of later on in the 3 weeks close to Tisha B'Av. But interestingly enough, when a human being, right, takes an inanimate object like a rock, like a stone, and shines it and polishes it and then puts it on themselves, what does that stone supposedly show? Status, importance. This has a lot of ramifications, but it's the full circle. Where an ornament taken from the inanimate level becomes used by a human being to show the great stature of the person themselves. Ideally, this is the case with proper Torah, you know, the ornaments that the Torah has asked us, as we just finished reading, to create for ourselves. Big Day Kohuna, the garments of the Kohanim, and all of those things. Those are to beautify, glorify the person through using stones, plants, linen, right? All kinds of other lower levels that all come together and metals, gold, all to show stature, but true stature. We've gotten so used to the fraudulent expression of that, where a horrible, unworthy, loathsome person can have, you know, decorating them the most magnificent jewels and clothing and all that, and one. The more beautiful the ornament certainly doesn't mean the more valuable the human being, right, or more precious in God's eyes. But in theory, that's the concept. So here we say the tuma of a human being is described after the tuma of an animal because it's trying to show us the great possibility and potential of the human being. When each level doesn't reach its intended madriga, then the opposite of that, which is what we're going to see, is tameh, is that much worse. That's really what it's trying to say. And that's going to help us understand the pasuk in Tehillim. But let's go back and try to build up this concept by answering our first questions. The concept of sadness. Where do we see sadness associated with childbirth? Now you got to think back. Where do we see it? When HaKadosh Baruch Hu, so to speak, cursed Chava, the ramifications of the sin, here's the Lashon, in, back in Bereishis. This is the terminology. Harbe arba itzvonech. I will increase twice, twofold. I will greatly increase. Harbe comes from the Shorash, right? Harbe, rov, harbe, more. I will greatly increase harbe arba itzvonech, your itzavon, your... Now, what do we normally translate that as? But it's often translated, if you look in English, as trials or travails or difficulty in childbirth. It means sadness. I will greatly increase your sadness, veheronech, that your sadness and your gestation will be longer. Be'etzev teldi banim, with sadness you will give birth to children. Now, what does that mean, be'etzev? We normally translate it with physical challenges. We think about the contractions and the pain and all that. But the pasuk is not talking about that. The pasuk says, be'etzev, with sadness you will give birth to children. What is that? What is the notion that childbirth is interconnected? You cannot disentangle it from sadness. What is that concept? Isn't childbirth the happiest moment of a person's life? The most optimistic moment? But the Torah says, no. Be'etzev, you will give birth deep in your soul when you give birth is a abiding sadness that will be permanent, that will stay with you. Why? Here we get to start thinking about another very interesting, kind of view and a perspective on Torah. Okay, there was a book written called The Jew in the Lotus, right? Right, about Jews, a Jewish person went to the Dalai Lama to discuss ideologies. The Dalai Lama asked him, because this is entirely what Buddhism is concerned with, the Dalai Lama asked him, how does the Torah deal with afflictive states of mind? Essentially, sadness, melancholy, a sense of emptiness, a search and a yearning that can't really ever be fulfilled, a sense of lack of control and impermanence. How does your Torah deal with afflictive states of mind? Now, think about it. Does our Torah openly discuss psychological, emotional, spiritual, afflictive states of mind? No. The Torah is about stories, a narrative, picking and choosing strictly those stories that are necessary to answer some very specific questions, such as who are the Jewish people? What is our claim to Eretz Yisrael? Who are not the Jewish people? All the stories in Bereishis, they're all about who is Klal Yisrael and who is not, and how we became our claim to Eretz Yisrael. I mean, there a lot. Everything else is left out. Doesn't talk about Olam Haba. Doesn't talk about all those things. Doesn't even tell you why Hashem chose Avraham. There are stories without the details, without the background, just the facts. Also halacha. Look at this right here. It's presented. If a woman gives birth, she's tameh. Chazal tell us because she's sad. Why are we sad? Torah doesn't express it. Goes back to Bereishis. With sadness, you'll give birth to children. The Torah doesn't speak in essay form, certainly not about these type of things. So openly, the Torah does not discuss afflictive states of mind, and it's not a self-help book in an open kind of way. However, obviously, since the Torah is the hora'ah, instructions, light, all truth, these things are clearly discussed in the Torah, but in the Torah style, in these type of ways. The closest, you might say, where the Torah starts to talk about afflictive states of mind is Tumah. Tumah is clearly associated with sadness, and it's clearly what we mean when we talk about afflictive states of mind. How is Tumah and sadness going together? Because this sin, this curse, that you will give birth in sadness, and that's why you, in the 7 days after birth, there's sadness, which is the days of Tumah. It's all one category. It's all one group of ideas together. 7 days of Tumah, they're synonymous with sadness. Sadness comes in with childbirth. Childbirth and sadness is the curse for eating from the Eitz Hadas, right? That, sadness and childbirth. Why? The Eitz Hadas is the source of death. Hashem said, if you eat from it, you'll die. So let's put it all together. You eat from the Eitz Hadas, you die. Tumas meis makes you tameh. All tumah has to do with death. That makes you sad. that even is most felt at the, it's felt more most deeply at childbirth. How is tumah? Why is death the source of tumah? We started talking about this actually a little bit in the tefillah class because we're talking about washing negelvasser and taking off the tumah. How is tumah and death associated? Because death is the father of all tumah, therefore the father of all sadness. Therefore, there's something about that in childbirth. Okay, how is tumah the tumah? How is how is death the father of all tumah? So what is death? So death comes from eating the Eitz Hadas. Now we'll go back to this for a moment, but hopefully this is beginning to be well, like, you know, integrated into the way we think now, because we do talk about it a lot. Eating from the Eitz Hadas, you know what it means, right? Let's just put it in this perspective. In the Gan Eden, and the Gan is up here, right, in the person's psyche, okay? We know that when we talk about Adam, we say that Adam had a neshama klalius. His neshama included all neshamas of Klal Yisrael, really of humanity. What does that mean? It means that that story is not the story of a person in the ancient past who made a mistake and now we're suffering. When we say that Adam and Chav and Ish and Isha, they were one, right, really, in the beginning, had a neshama klalius, that means that every person's neshama experiences with that Adam, what those two people experienced. Their name was Adam. That was their name. And therefore, the story of the Eitz Hadas is everybody's experience, because that is, he is all of humanity. That's what it means. That story is the humanity story. Now, there are two trees in this Gan up here. There's the Eitz HaChayim and the Eitz Hadas Tovara. The Eitz HaChayim, we know, it's brought to us in this world as the Torah, truth, Emes, right? The Eitz Hadas is, as you know, subjectivity, right? Now, just imagine this, a person is holding on with two hands, one hand on the Eitz HaChayim, on truth, on permanence, that tree that it lives forever, permanence, truth, eternity, goodness, that's all symbolized by the Eitz HaChayim, that's a Kodesh Baruch Hu, it's the truth, right? And then there's the person. And with the other hand, we are all eating from the Eitz Hadas. We got our hand attached to the Eitz Hadas, which is subjectivity, finite existence, and the self as an independent, disconnected from HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Now, here's what happens. It's a constant tug of war. It's like what's supposed to happen is Ech Achdus, and we've spoken about it, the oneness, right? Yisrael, V'yoraisa, V'kodesh Brichu, one. What's supposed to happen is the Eitz HaChayim, that's our Torah, teaches us how to take the truths that come from the world of MS, the permanent world, let them flow through us and use our individuality to express them, right? And our perspective, our individuality, our unique oneness, our Tzelem Elokim, right, gives us from, you know, a sense of self that's from one side, the Torah from the other side joins together in the person. And the person uses their individuality to express those original truths, right? That was what we talked about, that with the Mishkan. We did this a lot. Now, what happens in that tug of war? Last week, we talked about what happens when you let go of the sense of connection to life, to expressing Torah in my day-to-day life. You let go of your existence as a human being on this world in material form through your own individuality and your own chachma and your own personality, bringing the Torah truths into the world. You'll just have such a desire to be attached to the emes, to the shechina, to what's eternal and perfect and true, to that light, that you just let go. The other option is you let go of the Eitz HaChayim, and what happens is a person becomes an agent of themselves, right? And they only react and act and choose according to their own sense of, you know, expressing themselves, and that's it. Now, that's the concept, right? When they ate from the Eitz HaDas, that means they let go of the Eitz HaChayim. Now, we said that Adam is a neshama klalius, means every human being goes through this. This is inevitable. It's a tug of war, and inevitably people will let go of the Eitz HaChayim and find themselves just clinging to their own self. Now, that is the source of death, because as soon as you let go of the Eitz HaChayim, you're dead, because then you're a person is living like an animal, temporarily, a finite X amount of years, indulging themselves. And there's no permanence, and there's no spirituality, and there's no purpose to it, and it has no higher, you know, no higher goal, nothing. That's called death. That's called tumah. Tumah comes from the word atum. Atum means closed up. There's other ways of thinking about closed up. You can think about it in a number of ways. Number one, you're in atum with an aleph, or sasum with a samach also. Closed up, blocked, totally blocked. So you think about a well of water that's totally stopped up and the water can't find its way out. It tries to find other routes. There's a sense of being closed up, a sense of being blocked. Now, there's a number of ways to think about it. Let's think about it first philosophically, intellectually. A person is closed. They cannot see outside of their little delusionary world of themselves. They're completely blocked to the real world, to the truth. They don't see the big picture. All decisions are made. All reactions are made just in relationship to what I feel, what I want right now. It's very limited. It's very blind, and it's all closed up. However, now, go to the next level. People, therefore, when they're tuma, there's an emotional sense of blockage. Where does that come from? That's what Hirsch explains, that all tumas, which are associated with death, are also can be understood by the person emotionally being completely blocked and blinded and locked up. How does that work? He talks about nida. He talks about childbirth. He says like this, when a human being, we know, right, that we have this concept of the Eitz HaChayim. And a person is more than their biological self, and they're more than their biological urges. And they have free choice, and they can choose to express Hashem's will in this world. But then what happens to a human being? Natural forces of life itself overcome a person. For a woman, the menstrual cycle just happens. You don't choose it. So then, and it affects your emotions, and affects your body, it affects everything. So then you start to think, you know, I'm deluding myself. I'm not some type of free creature that can choose my destiny. I'm a victim. I'm a slave to forces of nature that I share with every four-legged animal that are stronger than me. I'm fooling myself. And emotionally, a person starts to feel the melancholy, the sadness, the sense of I'm a biological creature acted upon by biological forces and therefore destined to erode, to get old, and to be impermanent, like every other biological thing, like everything else that lives and dies, and that's all I am, and what's the point of struggling so hard against those forces? I'll never overcome them, and person emotionally loses sight of their identity as a Tzelem Elokim, as permanent, as eternal, as expressing Hashem's, you know, vehicle for Hashem's expression in this world. That's an emotional blockage which grips a person, and it's very hard to see beyond it, and that takes place could take place in the menstrual cycle. It takes place also a different way with added aspects in birth. What happens in birth? Why is there a sadness in birth? Interestingly enough, prior to eating from the Eitz HaDaas, okay, HaKadosh Baruch Hu told them, Pru Urvu, have a lot of children and fill up the world. But what was the point of having children before death, before eating from the Eitz HaDaas? Which means, let's get eating from the Eitz HaDaas out of its like little fairy tale image. Before becoming totally attached to our subjectivity, ourselves, okay, and using other physical things to define ourselves and forgetting about that we're defined through how we express Hashem in this world. And that brings death. That was really physical death that represents the spiritual disattachment. And that brings that sense of tuma. What was the point of having children prior to this state of mind? Not existing in this state of mind. Imagine, what would be the point of having children? If we were completely attached to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, theoretically, and therefore we would be permanent, which is the end goal, which is the ultimate stage, Tchias HaMesim and all that, the end of the process, what we're working towards, a real permanence, a real eternal existence. That's where the neshama goes after it leaves this body, to an eternal existence, right? What if we could experience that and live like that now? What would be the point of having children? Expansion. More people, more variant, more human beings, more varied individuals to express Hashem's will in this world. But after a person eats, so to speak, eats in the Eitz HaDaas, after Hashem creates the reality, because in this world, that human beings live in a finite way and are always in a tug of war and go back and forth, and very often get caught up, let go of the Eitz HaChayim, and get caught up in their impermanent life, right? And that becomes their self-definition because it's blindness. That's blindness. That's death. What becomes the point of having children now in a world where there is death and impermanence? To replace oneself. because a person is not going to be eternal, and a person can't live forever. And when a person gives birth, deep inside their psyche, they know, and they feel the afflictive states of mind, they feel the melancholy, the sadness of impermanence. This child is because I'm impermanent. This child might succeed where I failed. They'll do better than me. They'll achieve more in their time. They won't be such a victim of the tug of war. They'll have more clarity, and they'll go mechayel, they'll chayel from one achievement to the next, and they'll climb that mountain, and they'll get way past where I ever got to because I kept lurching backwards and forwards, and this child is going to go beyond. And we recognize when we have the child that it's because we're impermanent. Physically, we're impermanent. We get caught up in that impermanence, and we think it's permanent, and therefore...
A white sienna needs
to move. A white sienna. We get caught up. Not only do we get sad, this is the dichotomy. We're so sad because of the impermanence that often it leads a person to try to attach themselves to more impermanent things to heal that sadness, right? And that never works. That's where people are constantly running after the next object or the next achievement or the next thrill or the next person in their life, whatever, all things to heal the sense of pain that comes from being impermanent and not attached to truth. And those things are impermanent in and of themselves. And that is deeply embedded in the psyche of the person. So here's how the whole thing goes. Why are they sad? What is tumah and sadness? So the whole structure is the curse of death comes from Eitz Hadas. Okay? Death is impermanence on many levels. There are many levels of being dead physically, right? There's death, which is impermanent, and then there's spiritually being disattached. That's a form of death that leads to impermanence and seeking impermanent things to satisfy that, which doesn't work. Smart people stop seeking impermanent things to satisfy that void, and they start looking for permanent things, right? By the way, the Buddhists are very, very adept. They're excellent. They're highly, developed in expressing the pain and the suffering of the realization of the impermanence of all things and the foolishness in attachment to things, to anything that's people, objects, identities, status. They see it's all impermanent, but their solution is the only way to attach to something permanent is to disattach completely from everything else, go sit in the Himalayas on a mountaintop in a hermitage and meditate. Now, you could then get some people experience the transcendence of attaching to the light or to Hashem or whatever it is that gives them bliss to God, but that is not, it doesn't really work for most people, and certainly, as we spoke about last week, not at all what HaKadosh Baruch Hu wants. That is not. You got to do it here. So here's how it works. The Eitz Hadas, eating from it metaphorically, right, creates death physically, spiritually. That creates tumah. Tumah is a state of mind where you're blocked, where you're gripped, where you do not feel like you're functioning in a easy, fluid, flowing type of way, but you're gripped in your head either by not seeing clearly, in your emotions that stop you from functioning well, from being productive, from you get depressed and you get disheartened, and that's probably what women feel this much more with the hormone, with the PMS and all that is probably associated with this, that there's a sense of melancholy and a sense of being down and a sense of being controlled by greater forces, and that grips a person and that stops a person from progressing. And by the way, even physically, when people are gripped by negative emotions, they also often find it's expressed physically in their body. Back pains and knots and tensions, and very often people grip their jaws. We grip, and when a person starts holding on to certain discomfort and that type of tension, everything goes out of whack. Physically, emotionally, right? And the objective is to let... And by the way, the Eastern religion, that's why their whole yoga business is fluidity and flow and everything moving smoothly and no gripping anywhere and everything, right? And everything being at a scent, right? So that... And all so and the breathing that has to flow smoothly and easily without being caught up in, being stuck... That's the concept. We understand it. It's a basic human truth. So therefore, here's how we go back to these things. Why are they sad for 7 days? That sadness is associated with the recognition of impermanence. How do you do a tikkun? For men, for boys, it's going to be a bris milah on the seventh day. The orla, Rashi tells us, the word orla, that part that has to be removed, the definition of it is susum, what's blocking, what's atum, tame, the same words are used, because in a man, more than in a woman, that's the organ of the body that is most likely to distract a person, to let them let go of the Eitz HaChayim, see themselves as an agent strictly of themselves or their own satisfaction. That's what's going to blind the person. And when we remove the Arla, it's me. What we're doing is, both physiologically, it seems, and also spiritually, what we're doing is we're allowing a person to get over that, to remember all the time by that sign on their body that their every aspect of their life, physical, the most physical, can be elevated and can be a vehicle for connection as opposed to disattachment from Hashem. For a woman, by the way, it's going to the mikvah after the cycle of the Nida cycle now, and it's always water, by the way. It's always water that is kind of like the antidote to this melancholy, to this tumma. It's always water that is mitaher. It's a mikvah that is mitaher, right? Because the concept of water is life. Water pre-existed all the other aspects of creation. We don't know when water is created. We just know it was there. And not only was water there, the pasuk says, right? V'ruach Elokim mirachefet al pnei hamayim. Water and the ruach Elokim go together. The spirit of Hashem is hovering over the waters, which is why, by the way, people go to the water when they have that. They need to think or to, you know, connect somehow. You see a lot of people sitting by water, and that is also something we've experienced. So that sadness of the 7 days of tumma, the 7 days of tumma of nida, the 7 days of tumma of childbirth, the sense of, you know, of impermanence, of not being in control, that's the sadness, that's the tumma, and that has to be, in a sense, there's a tikkun for that, that comes with, as we said, mila or water. Now, let's talk about, the questions we asked in the beginning, the concept that you can't do a mitzvah because you're sad, the Torah is not telling you that. The Torah is trying to get you, of course we do mitzvahs when we're nida, of course there's no sadness in doing a mitzvah, it's really the opposite. What ends up happening is the mitzvah is the only thing that is a tikkun, that neutralizes, that undoes this sense of sadness. You have to go through the sense of sadness. It's inevitable. There are 7 days of tumma, which means it is an inevitability in a person that it'll be an ebb and flow. They will go from these two, you know, experiences, from feeling very connected to the Eitz HaChayim to feeling disconnected and just eating from the Eitz HaDaas all the time, as we talk about. This is what's going to happen. There is tumma and tara in the day-to-day cycle of everyone's life. Today, we are not so connected to these topics because we don't have a base of Migdash where it was very relevant to know when you were tumma and when you were tara, when you had come in contact with a dead body, when you weren't. Very important. Everybody was always aware what status they were in at that moment. Always. And today, we only have nida. All we have is nida left, really, and tumas mace a little bit. You wash your hands when after cemetery. We really don't have all those halachas anymore because they're not relevant technically because we don't go to the Beis HaMikdash. The one that remains is Nida, really, you know, is the most chamor one, the severest one. It reminds us of this reality that is inevitable for every person, and so we shouldn't get caught up in it. We shouldn't be gripped by it. We shouldn't get blinded by it. It's a natural fluctuation in the way a person thinks, in a person's feelings, and the idea, the objective is never get sucked into it, never remain in that state. It's temporary, and then you push yourself out of that state and you purify yourself, which is the feeling of clarity, of not being blocked, of being that vehicle, of having that flow through you from a Kadosh Baruch Hu through the person, and not getting, you know, disconnecting anywhere along that channel. Here we said that the Medrash says, Isha ki tazria, when a woman gives birth, that's what David HaMelech means, achor v'kedem tzartani, for what's after, and what's before you created me, v'tashes alai kapecha, and you put your hands on me. Rav Gedal Yeshur says that achor, the concept of achor, is the idea that the body, he talks about it's the body. There's many ways to say it. There are many approaches. We said before, achari, what comes after, which is the afterworld, and Kadam, what comes first, this world together. You created me with both of them. Another way of saying it is Achor. What comes Achare, the human being, as we talked about in the beginning, that is the end of the whole process of the creation, the culmination, the creature that's supposed to look at every other aspect of the Bria and utilize it and elevate it to express through themselves Hashem's will in this world. That's Achor. That's the body that's created after everything and has aspects of everything in it. Right? And we said, because it's the greatest, when it is cut off from its level, when it's Tameh, when it's disconnected, it's worse than all the previous levels. It decays worse, it smells worse, it creates more disease. Right? It doesn't just go down to the level before it. It gets worse than the first level. So that's the human being. So much potential. That's Achor. What? Achare, the guf, the body that's created after all things. And then v'kadam, and what's before? What's kadam? What's kadam? Kadam always reminds us of kodem, right? The kadmono shel olam, the one that preceded the world. That's my neshama. That's what came first. That was the purpose of the whole creation. That's the spiritual force that brought the world into existence. So you created me with the body, which is the, you know, which is the final end, the perfect final touch of creation, and the neshama, which is the core, the reason, the original reason for creation, and you put the two of them together. Now those are very strange bedfellows, right? The body that can be so easily disconnected, and the neshama, which is connected. And by the way, notice that we juxtapose the two every day when we, in the morning, when we say Asher Yatzar, which talks about the excretory system, right? And then right after we talk about the body, and it's like most kind of like, you know, in, you know, the functions that are most representative really of the decay, the constant eventual decay of man, you know, all things decay, all things are, you know. And then right after that, we talk about Elokai, Neshama, Shanasata, Bitahorahi, we put together Asher Yatzar, the bathroom bracha, and the neshama. Now, the last two couple words of the bathroom bracha of Asher Yatzar are mafli lasos, right? Mafli lasos. You do wonders. That idea is explained that the wonders, the pele that Hashem does is putting the two together. It's so unlikely. And that's what the other religions don't get, how the two work together. They say, just separate. You can't have both. They can't live together. It's a tug of war, and there's always going to be the one side or the other side will win. It can't be both. So we say, no, that's the Pele. That's Mafli. Pele means that's the wonder. So David Melch saying, Achar v'kadam tzartani, you created me either for the afterworld and for this world, or for with my body that has all drives of all the physical creation, has some aspect of it is in my body. We have minerals in our body. We have elements from every aspect of creation in our bodies, right? So we are physical in its entirely like the physical world, and a desire to be attached to every aspect of the physical world. We want everything. We want the inanimate world. We want the plant world. We want the animal world. We want to use everything, experience everything, be part of everything. And you also created me with kodem, with my neshama, which is only wants to be attached to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Like, what's a person supposed to do? And this is a part of the sense of the affliction, because a person knows something's wrong when they're impermanent. Why are we sad? Let's just ask this question. Why should we be sad that we're impermanent? Why should anyone be dissatisfied by the fact that life is impermanent? Why should that create afflictive states of mind? Tuma. Why should we be sad that we can't achieve something, eternity, permanence, that no one ever achieved? Why are we dissatisfied that we can't be all-knowing or completely in control of our life when no one ever achieved that anyway? Because the reason we're sad, the reason it afflicts us, is because we know intuitively that it's not the natural state of man. We know intuitively that man should be eternal. And man should be perfect. And man should have das, should have knowledge. And man should see clearly the big picture, should be tahar. We know that's what should be. And compared to that, when we're not, we feel so unhappy and dissatisfied. The experience of being dissatisfied is a very healthy feeling. And I don't mean dissatisfied that I don't have that object. Deep dissatisfaction that I'm not permanent, that I'm not all-knowing, that I don't understand everything, that I can't control everything. The only reason a person feels that is because they know that they're tzelem elokim, and really on the highest madrega they could be those things, and they're not, and that's where the sadness comes from, right? So David HaMelech is saying, you created me constantly with this tension, which leads to a constant feeling of being unsettled, because I know what I could be and I know when I'm not there, and the difference, the distance between the two is the extent of the melancholy or the sadness. And then he says, "Vatashes alai kapecha," but you put your hand on me. Now that's when we, like we say on Yom Kippur, right, that Hashem is no same yad. He gives a hand to who? Leposhim, to people that make mistakes, to sinners. He gives them a hand to pick them back up. When you put your hand on me, Vatashes alai kapi, it's like you pat me on the back or you give me your palm, right? You lift me up, right? We say in Akapayim Yisu'uch, he'll lift you up on his palms, right? Your feet, he'll put your palms under your feet and help you walk. In other words, we know that HaKadosh Baruch Hu gives us this difficult challenge, but in a sense helps us along, gathers us up and supports us with the palm, so to speak, of his hand, lifting a person up and pushing a person along, because really it's an overwhelming task. And as long as a person recognizes this, that it's a constant natural fluctuation and a constant natural kind of dynamic in a person, and they know that HaKadosh Baruch Hu is pushing them along, it gives them a sense of hope. And I just want to end with this idea that the difference between a tzaddik and a rasha, okay, because David HaMelech talks about it in Perek Aleph in Tehillim. He talks about the tzaddik as a deeply rooted tree, that's the Eitz HaChaim, and the rasha, who's just like leaves blowing in the wind, in other words, completely disconnected from the tree, just blowing in every wind. And then if you look in the Midrashim, you look in really, Radak brings it down, what is the word resha? Resha, the word resha, we use Russia very, kind of generically. Every bad guy is a Russia. But Russia has a very scientific meaning. It's used in Tanakh in numerous places to mean movement or chaos or fluctuation. A Russia is a person that's lurching from here to there. And tzaddik is like hin tzaddik, a consistent measure, right? When you measure somebody, a liter of liquid, or you weigh them out, a pound of some dry goods, and you have a weight, that weight is an even, a stone that's tzaddik, consistent, exact, never changing. It's exactly what it is. You can weigh anything against it. The difference between a tzaddik and a rasha is not that each person doesn't waver between these two drives or forces. A tzaddik is tzedek, that means consistent. Consistent basically stays attached to tahara. Whereas a rasha doesn't mean they're the worst person that ever lived, even though that's how often we use it. When the Torah uses the word rasha, it means they're always in flux. A little bit they're attached to the right thing, and then they lose their grip, and then they fall, and they're engaged, and they're completely like swirling in their little whirlpool of self-interest, and then they feel bad, Rishayim Maleim Charat, Rishayim are always regretful. They feel terrible, so they jump back and hold on to the MS for a while, and then they're like the waves. They're lurching, and they're shifting, and they're moving, and they're somewhere else, and then they indulge in, the Eitz Hadas. Then they feel bad, and that's the difference between the tzaddik and the rasha, is simply consistency. That is a difference, is consistency.
Right.
Not in the lack of the experience, but in the consistency. Okay. Everybody, Mir Tashem, starting the next 2 weeks, we bring your Haggadahs. Okay? Any questions, you can come over to me. Also, I mentioned the beginning here, there's a hat sale. Come look at these things. And thank you for your tzedakah. Yeah.
Okay, so the first thing is, but yes. Not everyone is going to have to get married.
True.
So,